Hello and welcome to another episode of We're Drunk and We Know Things with me, Rob Dudley, and Mike Dean.
Hello. Taking a swig of beer every time.
Every time.
Every time.
In this month's episode, we're sat outside the Cock and Bottle in the Royal Square in Jersey. The sun is shining, the seagulls are cawing.
It is
ridiculous. No doubt you'll hear some of them later on. It is absolutely stunning out here, to the point where we nearly considered not recording a podcast at all, just sacking it off and having a few beers in the sun.
We had technical issues. We'll have to do two afternoons out down the pub.
But our commitment to you, dear listener, is such that here we are, ready to crack on with this month's episode, which covers off the letter D.
That's what I do. I drink. And I know things.
So this month we're doing Dr. Strangelove, which is a movie that I wasn't actually that familiar with. It's something I've seen a fair few times, but never something that's grabbed my attention too much. But fair to say, over the course of the last couple of weeks of preparation, good Lord, those seagulls are loud. Over the last couple of weeks of preparation, it's become more apparent how amazing this is, actually.
So, to give it its full title, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Stanley Kubrick?
Yep,
so
Terry
this
Southern,
is
Peter
our
Grant.
First Kubrick movie.
Yeah, I would say so. Probably going to end up doing a few more.
Definitely.
I'll press not to.
When was it released?
It was released in 1964, January 24th. The details around its release we'll go into after we've talked about the plot and whatnot, but...
Okay, fine. Let's crack straight on with a plot summary. What's it about, Mike?
Benedict Cumberbatch is a surgeon who's very, very, like, cocky and arrogant, and he's driving his fast car one day.
Mike, yeah. Mike, that's Doctor Strange?
No! What a knee slapper.
Did you watch the wrong movie?
I might have done. Doctor Strange is turning to Cumberbatch on the atomic bomb at the end...
Yeah, waving his cowboy hat.
That's not...
No.
You know what? I always get Slim Pickens and Benedict Cumberbatch mixed up.
Yep, it's understandable. I mean, they're both...
They're basically the same person.
Very English.
One is an actual honest-to-God cowboy and one is Benedict Cumberbatch. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, so this movie is set right in the middle of the panic of nuclear war, basically, the fear of nuclear war.
I think it's because what have we got? When was the Cuban Missile Crisis?
61. Yeah.
3 years later.
Yeah.
And it focuses on a worst case scenario, let's put it that way.
It's a fustercluck of people doing the wrong thing, basically, isn't it? It's a farce in the truest sense of the word, kind of thing. Kubrick was obsessed with nuclear war from like the 50s, basically. He read Kahn's book about in the event of nuclear war, thermonuclear war, whatever, and was just obsessed with it. And he found a book by Peter Grant, I want to say, without looking at my notes, called Red Alert, or 2 Hours from Terror in the UK. And he was going to make a straight thriller, so a straight up, like, theatrical, dramatic version of that story. And over time, became convinced of the farcical aspects of mutually assured destruction and got Terry Southern on board, and now we have Dr. Strangelove.
And I think it's worth mentioning at this point that whilst you may not immediately believe it, this is probably one of the funniest dark comedies ever to grace the silver screen.
It is a weird mix of tones, I mean, to say the least.
Okay, so let's quickly run through the plot summary. We have basically a situation whereby, spoiler alert, for, again, a film in 1964. We should stop doing this. We have a situation where an American Air Force base commander...
Jack D. Ripper,
and we'll talk more about him later,
the name's
has completely lost his shit.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
He's gone a little bit cuckoo crazy.
This man
pants,
is a psychopath.
And takes advantage of some war games to order his entire fleet of B-52 bombers attack their targets.
As a bit of background, this is actually a thing that was true. During the Cold War, especially at that time, they had B-52 bombers armed with nuclear weapons flying at Russia. And then at a fail-safe point, as in a point of no return... They were radioed and said, don't worry, we don't want to kill tens of millions of people. Turn around and come back. And unless they got that radio message, they would just go and do it. Now, that's an actual thing which happened, which is not news, but it was news to me when I, in the research for this, which frankly terrified me.
Oh, this is... I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about the historical context in a second, but it is truly terrifying, given
so
that
they,
this is all based on very real potential. So they get given an attack plan which happens to be Plan R. Plan R having been designed to be completely uncountermandable.
Yes, indeed.
Except in one very specific circumstance.
It's in the event that Washington, like, the entire chain of authority has been killed because of a shooting war on American soil, and there's no alternative but to go and bomb the enemy, essentially, in this case, Russia, because it's the only time that a general can order a nuclear attack.
Yeah. So the president has nothing to say about this happening. The whole point of Plan R is that he's already gone. And what we end up with is a situation where these bombers are going full tilt into Russia, all armed with 40 megatons worth of...
Something bananas,
40 megaton warheads.
They say at one point it's all the... Every bomb and bullet added together in the whole of the Second World War is not as explosive, doesn't have the explosive power of the bombs they carry or something.
Yeah, one of the bombs they carry.
Yeah, indeed.
And they're running full tilt at their targets, and hilarity ensues.
Yeah, pretty much. So, off the back of this, the American government or American War Room is informed that it's happening. General Turgeson, played by the insanely amazing George C. Scott, against his own better judgment, which again we'll go into later. They convene in the War Room, not a real place. This is really interesting, actually. When Ronald Reagan got sworn in, the first thing he did was, I want to see the War Room. And they said, well, there's not a War Room. And he said, no, there is. I saw it on a film. And he was talking about Dr. Strangelove.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Also scary in its own way.
He had quite bad Alzheimer's the whole time he was president, so...
It's amazing that we're still here.
Moving on.
They all decamp to the War Room. The American president, all of his advisors, all of his generals, chiefs of staff, all male. Interestingly enough, there is only one woman in the entire movie.
Yeah.
And they have to contact the Russians to explain, basically, that... they're about to be bombed.
Yeah, in one of the greatest scenes ever.
And what then comes to pass is various attempts to try and pull the bombers back.
Well, I mean, George C. Scott, some of the generals are saying, listen, let's take advantage. We're already halfway there. Let's commit.
Well, this was the whole point of Ripper's madness, which is actually quite cold and calculating, is that
apart
strategically...
Apart from the fluoridization.
The whole point is that once that first bomb is dropped, you have to commit. You have no choice.
Yeah.
And he thinks that he's put them on this path. The president is trying desperately to... use a combination of technology to stop the bombs from dropping and diplomacy to make sure that they don't get nuked back.
Yeah.
We're then introduced to a very interesting concept of the doomsday machine, which means that fundamentally if any bomb were to drop on Russia, the entire of the Earth would be irradiated for 92 years.
Yeah. It's 93.
So in other words, there is no way that they can prevent complete catastrophe. It doesn't matter. And... we then proceed to go through an attempt to get the... the only way you can get the bombers to come back is by punching in a recall code, right?
Yep.
So the president does two things. He says, get me the recall code, and they send men to attack General
Ripper.
And
he tells the Russian president, shoot them all down.
He tells the Russian president, not only shoot them all down, but
give
them a full readout.
Yes, I know the
robot is. Gives them a full readout on how to do this, where they're going, what kind of countermeasures they might be carrying. The only problem with this is that a particular plane, the star of the show, piloted by, frankly, probably the shining light of the entire film, Slim Pickens.
He's only in it accidentally, but again, we'll go into that in a minute.
They get attacked, but are damaged, but aren't disabled.
Basically, their radio and receiver is damaged, so they can't receive the recall code.
They can't receive anything at all, and they're also flying at something like 20 feet above the ground,
it's crazy,
they're not getting picked up on radar either.
The whole of the plot is, it's two competing narratives, in that you're backing the War Room, and you want them to stop, because you don't want the world to end, but in a weird way, the way that they put together all the scenes aboard the plane, you're kind of behind them and want them to...
Oh, there's a massive amount of tension, especially
it's really
when...
It's weird. You're rooting for them to bomb Russia and you're rooting for the end of the world not to happen. It's very strange.
They managed to get the recall code out to most of the planes, they celebrate. Some of them have been shot down, all the rest have been recalled, and then they get the message.
And Peter Sellers just says, oh, for like 5 minutes. Oh, Oh, on the phone. Jesus, that's so good.
They get the message that Slim Pickens' plane is still airborne. Mm. And again, a classic comedy of errors. The President Sellers directs the Russian Premier to put all of his air force over the primary and the secondary targets, not knowing that in the damage, Slim Pickens B-52 is now losing fuel and can't make it to either. So he picks
below radar
a target of opportunity, and the entire thing ends with, well, it ends
with the end of the world.
With the end of the world, basically.
To the strings of Vera Lynn.
Although possibly there may be some mine shafts. Who knows?
Perhaps.
Okay, yeah, so on the backdrop of this, the entire thing is, let's talk a little bit about production and cinematography. Because the entire thing is shot in black and white.
Sure, which they didn't have to.
Nope, they could totally have afforded colour.
No, absolutely.
Again, our second black and white movie. We will get back to Technicolor.
Think about what our first one was there for a second. But no, Kubrick was obsessed for a good decade from the sound of things, or a good 5 years, that's half a decade for those running metric, about nuclear war and the dangers of. And he read this book, Red Alert, by Peter Grant, which he wanted to adapt as a straight screenplay. And I think the roots and the kind of the tendrils of that screenplay or that version of the movie are definitely still running through the film. And that's why I say it's a bit weird mix of tones, because you could watch Strangelove all the way through without laughing, except for the performances. It's played straight, apart from George C. Scott and one of Sellers' performances.
I think even then, they are played straight. They're just comedic.
Oh, no, George C. Scott, he does a backwards roll at one point. And that bit when he's, what about the big board and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, but that's...
He's definitely very...
Firstly, his backwards roll was accidental, right? He tripped and fell.
Oh, did he really?
And recovered, yes.
Okay.
There is a scene where he's marching across the war room and he stumbles, falls, does a perfect forward flip back on his feet and does it all in one take.
And pointing up at the big board.
And you could say, actually, he is the ultimate jingoistic general.
Absolutely.
He is fundamentally comedic.
He's everything that Kubrick doesn't like about the American military, isn't he? He's got the mistress. He's basically like a teenager, isn't he? He's taking calls from his girlfriend at the table with the president. Of course, no, I have tremendous respect for you as a human being.
I'm going to make you Mrs. Buck Turgenson.
All that kind of stuff. He's everything that Kubrick obviously doesn't like about the kind of American military, or perhaps even the American man. And it is played to a T by George C. Scott, which is.
Let's talk a little bit about his performance before we kind of get back to production, because there is a fair quantity of rumour around whether or not what we see on screen was what Scott ever intended us to see.
Yeah, I don't think it's rumour. I mean, Kubrick said, do one way over the top, just to, like, get the air out the lungs kind of thing, get it off your chest, do one crazy, and then do your serious version, your proper George C. Scott, you're one of the great actors of our time version, and then invariably use the over-the-top version every single time, because he tricked him into being in a comedy, basically.
Yeah.
The other thing he did was, Kubrick was a grandmaster at chess, so beat him at chess all the time. Scott loved playing chess.
Also, the second podcast where we've had a major star of the movie, and in fact, in this case, a major star and the director, what is it with Hollywood and chess?
I don't know.
Nuts.
It's like problem solving, innit? Or something, I don't know.
Wouldn't have thought those two things naturally go together.
Well, I suppose, I don't know, I mean... Well, that's a whole big psychoanalysis of Stanley Kubrick, which... There's not enough hard state memory in the universe to record that. Yeah, hard state memory.
Solid. It's one solid for our... state.
Shut up. Where were we? George C. Scott. So yeah, so you manipulate him with chess by saying, I tell you what, if I beat you, then you get to do the scene, you have to do the scene how I want. If you beat me, then you get to do the scene how you want, and he never beat him.
No.
So he does these massive overblown performances, which are amazing. I mean, he's almost like a Tex Avery cartoon or something. He's so over the top, but it feels so pitch perfect in this somber black room around this enormous poker table. It feels so pitch perfect. And so pitch black. It's so good.
I mean, this is it. Production-wise, or setting, everything was built on set. The sets were constructed for this movie.
Yeah.
And the war room, which is probably iconic to the point where, as you say, Reagan would have asked to, I want to see it, was built out of poured concrete.
Well, it's let's go back to set design, because I want to talk about Ken Adam
quite a bit. What else?
So yeah, so I mean, the biggest star in the film is Sellers, Peter Sellers. Obviously, they sold the film. He'd been in Lolita, where he played four or five parts. I think it might have been five, actually. Confession time, haven't seen Lolita. Played four or five parts.
Always feel a bit dodgy downloading it from the internet.
You're never sure if you get the right version. You really... This hasn't got Peter Sellers in it, and it's very graphic. So the studio greenlit the movie based on the condition that Peter Sellers would play multiple roles, because they were convinced, with the fact that Lolita was a success because of Peter Sellers playing multiple roles. So Stanley Kubrick said whatever he had to get the film made, basically. Said to Peter Sellers, by the way, we're making a new film, you're playing four parts. And Peter Sellers balked, understandably. But Stanley Kubrick basically said, shut up, you're doing it.
Yeah. I'm Stanley Kubrick. I'm technically more famous than you are, yeah. Although you're incredibly famous.
So originally he was going to play the British officer, the president,
Doctor Strangelove.
How did I forget that one? And he was going to play
the pilot.
He was going to play...
What's the pilot's name?
Major
King Kong.
Yeah, Major King Kong. So he couldn't do the Texan accent, got Terry Southern, who was the co-writer of the farcical comedy screenplay, to record all of his lines with a Texan accent, because Terry Southern was American, and then listen to them on an enormous big headset radio recorder to try and get it down. Got it down, still wasn't very happy. Eventually managed to fall out of the suspended B-52 set they had suspended above the set, fell out of it and broke his ankle, and so couldn't do the pilot part because he had to climb around up and down ladders and all that kind of stuff. So Kubrick knew he couldn't replace him with an actor, so had to go and get an actual cowboy.
Oh, hang on, whoa. Slim Pickens is an actor.
No, but he is an actual cowboy.
He's also an actual cowboy, but he had been successfully...
He's a rodeo clown who became an actor. So he was an actual cowboy. He just happened to... Kubrick worked with him on One-Eyed Jacks, which Kubrick got fired for, and Marlon Brando took over as director. So he knew Slim Pickens. Slim Pickens turns up on set, like tasseled jacket, wide-brimmed Stetson.
In London, because this is all shot in London,
Shepperton Studios, right? Never been to England before. Turns up in Shepperton Studios, wide-brimmed Stetson, tasseled jacket, and people are like, oh, amazing, he's ready to go, he's already in costume. No.
That's just how
an actual
he dresses.
Cowboy. Amazing. So, I mean, he couldn't be more perfect for the part either, and Kubrick was right, you couldn't have got another actor to try and do that. You just had to get, especially with the time they had.
That. Yeah. And there's a fantastic scene fairly early on, when they receive the orders, he's asked...
Is that a speech?
Before the speech, he's asked the crew to verify the orders, and he goes to the safe. And you're like, what's he going to the safe for? Is he going in there for an order book? Is he going in there to get his gun? And he pulls out his Stetson and swaps his official issue Air Force helmet
and
for
oxygen supply,
a Stetson.
No less. This is before they have to fly before the radar, but anyway.
Yeah, and puts on this... from the rest of the movie, he's now wearing this cowboy hat. Fantastic.
So going back to Peter Sellers, he plays for three parts, and he basically improvises everything he says.
Yeah.
He says the first 10 seconds of what's scripted, and then just riffs, and it's... I mean, it is... a sight to behold. When I've rewatched it, I watched it twice this week. His ability to riff is insane. Those scenes where he's in the office with Ripper, when he's talking about, you asked me to feed what I did, you should feed me, and I did, boy, and all that, and he's following him around carrying. There's no reason he should be carrying that 50 cal machine gun around with him. I'm miming the machine gun. Can't see this, but believe me, it's a brilliant mime. I'm sure I'll be corrected on Twitter. I hope I am. But I can't imagine a better... I mean, it's better than... It's Clouseau good. It's better than Clouseau, which is a very bold thing to say, but...
I think this is it, is that not only does he turn in three performances, he turns in three perfect performances.
Distinct performances as
and
well.
And very distinct. I mean, you've got... he modelled his Lieutenant Mandrake...
Yep.
Group Captain Mandrake, yep. I should say, was apparently modelled after one of his commanding officers when he was in the RAF.
Well, apparently he used to go and get extra supplies and rations and stuff for the men in his squadron by pretending to be an officer. So this is something that he then turned into that.
We have the president, who was actually modelled after one of the senators, I think.
I think so. Well, he was meant to be like... Basically, he was going to play in really camp.
Yeah.
Because in the 60s, camp meant weak. Less said about the better. But they decided, like, literally on set, that it would be better that he is the only level-headed man. Like, the president is the only one that's got his head on him.
He's the,
like,
only sane person in the entire room.
I'm not going to let you make me the worst mass murderer since Adolf Hitler, all that kind of stuff. He's the only one that seems to actually be rational. Which is a better choice, certainly.
And, of course, we have the inimical...
Yeah, the titular.
German scientist. The titular, Jesus. No less. Dr. Strangelove, who
A performance turned up to 11.
Actually has surprisingly little screen time.
Yeah, he doesn't come in until like 40 minutes in, and the movie's only 95 minutes
long. You can see him.
Oh, you see him in the background.
You see him in the background.
Played by a very unconvincing body double.
But it's okay. It's a bit. At least it's not a little person this time.
Yeah, he's not a really close little person. Yeah, true.
But yeah, surprising little screen time. But oh my goodness, every single moment.
That's why it works.
Every single
it?
Word.
That's why it works, though, isn't it? Because if he was just in it as much as Turgeson,
yeah,
it wouldn't be as good that would get very, very tiresome very quickly, I think. This is it.
You don't have time to get tired. It doesn't have time to get really beyond the sheer shock of what you're seeing and hearing.
Sure, yeah.
Elements of it, of the characterization, are superb.
Yeah.
You know, the black glove that was, again, improvised.
Yeah, well, that's Kubrick had...
And Kubrick was wearing black gloves to hang the lights.
He knew that wearing one black glove would be so sinister, and it worked so well.
And, of course, he is German... he is blatantly one of the rescued Nazis.
Operation Paperclip, yep.
Yeah, which is kind of... You're left in no doubt when he firmly, salutes the President of the United States.
He accidentally calls him Mein Führer twice.
Yeah,
so
it's
good.
Brilliant.
But all of that is improvised, so that the hang with his life of its own, that's improvised, choking himself... When he's talking about how they have to procreate, it's a shot of it's a close up of Joseph's face, and the phantom limb is clearly grabbing his nuts. The Heiling Hitler, all that kind of stuff. That's all improvised. Like that bit at the very, very end. Skip to the end when he stands up and says, "Mein Führer, I can walk." That's improvised. I mean, it's like, how do you do that? Imagine Jim Carrey doing that.
I mean, the cast, the performances are all rock solid. There is not a weak performance in the entire movie.
And every time Sellers opens his mouth, look at everybody else, because especially the Russian ambassador. I can't remember the guy that plays him now. But
he was an English theatre actor, wasn't he?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. If you look at everybody else, and it is very hard to take your eyes off him, everybody else is stifling a laugh. It's amazing, and like really obviously, like hand over the mouth. Stifling a laugh. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. So James Earl Jones is also in the movie as Lieutenant Zoggy. He is on board the plane.
He's the bombardier.
He was seen... George C. Scott was cast because Kubrick saw him in Manhattan in Merchant of Venice with James Earl Jones. James Earl Jones met prompting... What was his name?
Slim
Pickens, thank you. We've had quite a lot of beer now. He met Slim Pickens, and he said to Slim Pickens, "What was it like working with Marlon Brando?" And Slim Pickens said to James Earl Jones, "He's the whitest man I've ever worked with." Although not like that, because he's a cowboy.
So do it again with the accent, please. Our listeners need some entertainment.
Nope. I was trying to summon that from deep within me, and then nope. Just going to be Cornish. "He's the whitest man, you know. I can't do a cowboy. What's this? I don't know what this is."
Like weird Irish Jamaican.
I can't even think what a cowboy sounds like now. You put me on the spot.
One of the things that I said to you when we were discussing this before we kind of sat down and actually started recording is every time I watch this film, I see something new. And that's true. That's not. This sounds like the kind of thing that people just say.
I bet it is.
But in this case, somehow I had managed to watch it maybe a dozen times without ever really appreciating the characters' names. And I don't know, having not read Red Alert, if these are directly lifted.
They're not.
But all of the characters have ridiculous names.
Yeah.
You have the fairly sensible Jack Ripper, the general, and Mandrake, the English captain.
Mandrake is so good.
But then you start to get, you know, into absolutely insane nonsense.
Well, even like Turgid Son is
so
like Turgid
Son, the yeah. son of something turgid. Yeah. And you're like, okay, great. Yeah. The Russian premiere is actually Premier Kissoff.
Yeah. And Jack D. Ripper, you know, it's like you say, it's something you wouldn't catch on the first viewing, but the more you watch it, the more you... Oh, there's a Bat Guano. He's literally batshit.
Bat Guano is my favourite character in the entire thing, and has probably one of the most amazing quotes.
That scene when Sellers picks up the two phones, the first one, damn,
doesn't work.
And then he picks up the second one, and it hasn't even got the cable attached. It's so good. I mean, that is so good.
And then thereafter, he's asked Bat Guano to get him some change. He's trying to place a collect call to the war room.
Call to the war room, and they won't let
him do
this,
and you go, what are they doing? Yep. But they won't accept the charges, and he hasn't got enough change on him. And you think, this is America to a T.
20 cent shorts.
And just when you're starting to think, oh, the American telecom system is nonsense, and the military and everything, you then get the scene where he's asking Bat Guano to shoot the lock off a vending machine.
Yeah, he wants to shoot the coin receptacle thing, yeah.
And Bat responds, okay, I'm going to get your money, but if you can't get the President of the United States on the phone, you know who you're going to answer to? The head of the Coca-Cola Corporation. It's like, oh, that moment is the only moment of true farce in the entire film.
Yeah, I would. Well, I think the other moment maybe is
he shoots the vending machine three times, reaches down to gather up the chain,
and the first one,
and one of the Coke cans sprays Coke in
his
face.
Okay,
it's
pure
slapstick.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
And to be honest, I'm not convinced that it needs it. But anyway, that's a discussion for a different time.
I mean, that scene where Tracy Reed, the only woman in the film, as we said. She is the mistress of Turgidson.
She is.
That scene where he's on the toilet and she's relaying the information that the world is about to end, there is about to be a nuclear war because he can't get off the shitter, is just ridiculous. She's in it twice, incidentally. The navigator's looking at a penthouse, and that's her in the magazine as well.
It is. Yeah. But she's the only woman.
She is the only woman, isn't it?
Anyway, continuing with the last couple of names, my personal favourite, by the way, is the name of the US president. Did you spot this one?
No.
He's President Merkin. His first name.
A pubic wig.
If anybody doesn't know, yes, a Merkin is a wig for people who have gone bald downstairs and wish they hadn't.
Wow.
So he's Merkin. Well, I can't remember his surname now.
Who's got alopecia of the nuts?
Many people. Don't judge them.
Do you get a disabled parking space if you've got baldness of the nuts?
Yeah, but you're never really going to put it up, are you?
Hard to prove, too, without getting arrested.
Reason for parking space. Ah.
I just hang a picture of my balls.
Yeah, but also, you could fake it. It's eminently fakeable.
It's true.
I mean, I don't think you get alopecia of specific body parts. Actually, my left testicle.
It would go without proving, I suppose. Yeah, fair enough. So, yeah, so let's talk about the production design, because it is insanely iconic. I mean, that war room is, like you say, it's like 100 metres by 80 metres, 40 metres tall. Ken Adam, who is the production designer on this, he's the production designer on a lot of the good Bond movies. If you've seen A Volcano Lair, it probably is Ken Adam. He is, you know, he is amazing. He worked on a lot of Kubrick films. He didn't work on 2001 because Kubrick worked closely with NASA, so there wasn't any room for artistic interpretation. So initially, he built the war room as a two-level room, and Kubrick loved it. And then about a year later, was like, actually, now you're going to build it. Don't do that. So it's, like I say, it's 100 by 90 by 40. It's black formica all the way across the floor, so everyone's got to wear slippers, because otherwise it's going to look all buffed and rubbish on camera.
And this is, I mean, this is, if you're trying to imagine what black buffed formica looks like, think black shiny soundstage from a musical.
Yeah, it's insane. And then you've got... the triangular front, which is supposedly Kubrick decided that would be better for taking the oncoming force of a nuclear blast, which is great, provided it's coming from that direction. otherwise, but anyway, far be it from me to question Stanley Kubrick. And in that enormous round table that Kubrick insisted they cover in green felt, because it meant
was shooting in black
and white. Yeah. It's meant to have the feel of a poker table, that they're playing poker for the world, essentially.
And of course, one of the most iconic set points is one of the walls covered with the big board.
The big board, but you'll see the big board. I mean, George T. Scott's worry, especially at the beginning, about you're going to let the Russian ambassador in here, but he's going to see the big board. Like, it's his constant reference to that is so good. It's so funny. But
I think it's also because, I mean, I don't know if it was in prior movies, but now if you think about any movie that involves some form of disaster scenario, there is always a big board.
The Bourne movies, you think the bad guys, the government in the Bourne movies, there's a big-ass board.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that they're now actually unwittingly taking the design points for, like, situation rooms from
definitely a room
Ken
like
Adams
that.
Set design.
There's definitely a room like that somewhere. Trump's definitely got a volcano lair somewhere like that, surely. Ooh, political. But yeah, so the other thing they did was the B-52 bomber. That wasn't available, like, to
go
and
have
a look
at. Well, they asked, right? They asked more than that. They asked the US Air Force, and the US Air Force said, what's the nature of this film? Mm. And they told them, and the US Air Force said, yeah, no, there is no chance we're letting you on one of our planes. Even if we were to let you, they're super top secret. They're in production. And bear in mind, the B-52 at this stage, sorry, I nerd out a little bit about planes, but the B-52 was state of the art.
Well, I mean, Love Shack is one of the great songs of our time.
Moving on. but yeah, so the Air Force wouldn't...
Piling up beside just to get down. Sorry.
The Air Force wouldn't let them on a real B-52.
That silence wasn't an edit point, was it? You were just freezing me out.
No, that's where I can fade in the B-52s later.
Okay.
But it's going to be the one about... Rock Lobster. It's going to be the wrong song.
The one about Rock Lobster. You mean Rock Lobster by the B-52s. There's an amazing Japanese ska band that do a cover of that. I highly recommend you check it out.
Maybe it's that, right? Maybe I'm fading that in under. See, when the producer's away...
Oh, Jesus.
So they wouldn't let them on a B-52.
Sure. They were using them, yeah.
But they probably had a couple that they could have spared. And as a result, I think the entire B-52 set was designed based off of, what, two photos?
The cockpit was built from two photos. And then they had the Air Force come down and visit and said, oh, you've got this, like, even down to the black box recorder and the receivers of the no-go codes and all that kind of stuff. They got it absolutely pitch perfect to the point where Kubrick pulled Ken Adam aside and said, listen, we're going to get in trouble for this film anyway. Are you absolutely sure you got all your, like, examples from legal means?
Are you sure you didn't actually commit some form of espionage?
Yeah. And Ken Adams got an accent, so you know they were suspicious of him.
But, and the thing is, I mean, the B-52, accurate or not, it is accurate, it's been verified.
Yeah, it's great.
But it is
even
an amazing piece
so
of
convincing.
Set building.
Yeah, it's so convincing, even if it wasn't. The fact that it's on two layers and it's built on two layers, you know, it's... It's amazing. I mean, you know that the Bombay doors at the end that Kong rides the bomb down from out of. So that ending was decided on about 14 hours before it was shot. So Kubrick said to Ken Adams, you need to build me. And the it was built as a one piece. It didn't have opening Bombay doors. So he said to Ken Adams, you need to be able to make operating Bombay doors in 14 hours so I can shoot the ending I want. So what they ended up doing is just cutting a big hole, because they were shooting in black and white, cutting a big hole, taking a photo first, then cutting a big hole, and literally just lowering two photos pasted to two pieces of curved MDF away, because you wouldn't be able to tell because it was black and white.
Yep.
But it's all ingenious. It's all ingenious. And that's all Ken Adams just being the greatest production designer of all time, as far as I'm concerned. But just, yeah, yeah.
I think the sheer quantity of stuff in this movie that was accidental or incidental or improvised or tricked, you kind of have to wonder how on earth it ever got
it's
made.
It's like a lucky accident that it is as good as it is, because, like, Kubrick had to have such a singular vision and be so sure of himself that, like, any lesser mind kind of thing couldn't have pulled it off. It does sound, the more you read about it, the more it just sounds like it's almost a coincidence that it's this good. It's crazy. It's crazy.
One of the big things when you watch this nowadays, and I mean, I was sat in quite happy watching this on a flat screen TV in the year 2017, which is a whole 16 years after 2001 was meant to have happened.
So much more futuristic when you say it 2017.
Well, it is futuristic, all right? We were meant to have already gone to Mars and obelisks and stuff.
Captain Scarlet got it super wrong.
Dum, 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 dum. Well, also, we're not puppets.
There is that.
Yeah. Is that you need to make sure when you're watching this film, and I say you need to, I would strongly recommend that you consider the context in which it was released, because we don't really have that whole Cold War mentality at the moment. I mean, we're getting a bit of it back, thanks to Trump, and
especially
Syria,
today.
And Putin. In fact, actually, it is quite a scary time to be alive. Anyway, so what we don't have is our kids aren't getting drilled in school on stop, drop, and roll.
No.
You know, this isn't something that's playing on everybody's mind as it was during the 60s. Because, again, I've spoken to my parents about their experience during the Cold War, and it was terrifying, and they lived in the Midlands.
I mean, that was reality, wasn't it? The beginning of that film, when they talk about the planes flying towards Russia and stuff, like I said at the beginning, I mean, that is reality.
Completely legitimate. Yeah, yeah. There was a massive, massive concern
it's a
about...
It's a super weird thing to make a comedy film about.
And when they made it, I mean, making one in, like,
the
2000, but... so this is the year after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah. So it's meant to be released on the 22nd of November 63. So the day they're going to screen it, Kennedy gets shot. Which is probably worse luck for him than it is for Kubrick, but it probably didn't feel like that way at the time. So they had to push it back. So they pushed it back to the 24th of Jan 64, and they had to edit certain bits. So the bit when Kong has a survival kit, and he's reading out the prophylactics and the tights and the chewing gum.
Yeah, and I think the fine line is, dang, you could have a good time in Vegas with all of that.
A fella could have a pretty good weekend in Vegas with that. Initially, it was a fella could have a pretty good weekend in Dallas with all of that.
Ooh,
so they changed that.
Burn.
It was one of the reasons that the pie fight ending, which we've completely forgot to talk about, was cut, is that initially in the pie fight ending, the president gets hit, Merkin gets hit with a pie in the face, and Turgeson says, our young president has been struck down in the prime of his life. Now, this was made 6 months before Kennedy got killed. 8 months before Kennedy got killed. So shockingly, they had to change that bit because that was a bit on the minds of the nation. So it was insanely on the mind of the public, which, like, now I think it loses a little bit, which is why it wouldn't work today. If you release that film today, it wouldn't work because it doesn't play on the times.
No,
as
it almost needs the gravitas that's lent to it by the reality of ongoing
that's why the
geopolitical
Rock works so well
situation.
Because everybody's afraid of chemical weapons at the time.
Really?
You know, The Rock.
You're legitimately
our generation's
comparing
Dr. Strangelove.
The Rock to... We're done.
The movie is really great, but we all know haters gonna hate. We all know the film's all right. These crazy people think it's shite. From the depths of the internet, we bring to you, it's Amazon One Star Review.
So this brings us to the reason I actually bother turning up to these things now, which is the one-star reviews. Again, this is another one which is like, oh, the Blu-ray shit, which, you know, fair enough, fair cop, actually, to be fair. If I bought a digital version, it was shit, I'd be annoyed as well. But there were some pretty good ones.
Wait. Just very quickly, because you get the quality of this movie shit is, are these people expecting, because it's on Blu-ray, that it's going to be upscaled, perfectly remastered, to 4K, full colour?
Because they don't read...
The film was made in the 60s, people. Expectations.
Yeah. If it says upscaled to 4K, you know, 8K remastering, blah, 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 cool. If it doesn't, then it will be okay. But otherwise, what do you want to do? Watch it on VHS? This wasn't as good as when I watched it in the cinema in the 60s. Do one, you douchebags.
No, you're not as good as when you watched it in the cinema in the 60s. Look at you with your pattern baldness and your left ball alopecia.
So the one-star reviews we had, there is one that's amazing. .co.uk, Amazon.co.uk, you let me down again. You're letting your American brethren be far crazier again. But the ones that are reviews from .com are amazing. There is one which is an essay, which, I mean, I tried to start writing down, but I'm serious. It's like 5,000-word essay. And then he responds to a comment on why it's not cool to joke about nuclear war. It's more just lame than it is funny. But there is a few, and they're all quite short, but they are good. Eleanor from 2014... Overrated, not funny. Which I can get how you wouldn't laugh at it.
It's harsh.
Yes. But it seems a bit harsh. But she then goes on to say boring, stereotypes, erroneous statements. Eleanor, presumably a nuclear war expert.
Yes. Does she specify?
Don't know. Didn't say.
Which statement she considers to be erroneous?
No, didn't say which statements. There's no facts to back her up with. Rob from 2015, which is meh, what a bore.
Yeah, I was having a bad day.
Yeah, well, you say you love it, but apparently August 2015...
We've all said things on the internet we don't mean. You told me last night you love me.
Zach G, presumably in the place to be, from April... Zach G, presumably in the place to be, from April 2016, just says stupid. Stupid. It's fucking stupid, you wankers. I'm paraphrasing now. I'm not sure how we got stupid from it.
Your name's Zach.
You bill yourself as Zach G.
You are literally...
Shit, do you think it's Zach Galifianakis? That's just occurred to me.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God, we just called out Zach Galifianakis on our podcast.
It's fine, we can deal with that. We called out Tim Berners-Lee last month.
And Dan Feb, who I was going to call him, but his name's actually Dan from Feb this year. Dan Feb. Strange. Couldn't finish it.
But did he love it?
It's only 95 minutes. It was strange.
Remarkably short.
It is strange.
Well,
the clue's in the name. Couldn't finish it. It's 95 minutes. What were you so busy doing, Dan?
I'd love to know where he jumped off. Where he got to in this movie that he thought, nope, that's enough.
Yeah,
too fucking weird for me.
It's gotten too strange now. Weird.
Right, so is
but
that
no,
UK?
No, my favourite one. This is just
US.
This is just US. It's Sudan C. Hayward from February last year, 2016. It's titled Awful, But My Husband Loves It. Name of your sex tape? First of all, Sudan C. Hayward. Had that one up my sleeve all week. So glad we're finally getting to say that. She says, it's too real. Not for the timid or those worried about the lives of their descendants. Because she is very sure, apparently, the nuclear winter is going to be a... It's a definite thing. It's going to happen. Title, Awful, But My Husband Loves It. Weirdly, that's also her review for anal sex. I'm sorry. With so many people sat around us, and I just had to say it. Why do you think I was saying, let's go to a quieter pub? I've had an anal sex joke up my sleeve for the last hour. Weirdly, named my sex tape.
This just gets worse and worse and
worse.
Oh,
that's my favourite bit now. It's my favourite bit. And that's it, unfortunately.
So that's it. Not the greatest collection.
Not the best. It was hard. It was hard pressed. There were like 19,000 reviews on Amazon.com or something insane. And there were 10 one-star reviews.
And if that doesn't speak to the quality of this film.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Nothing does. You've enjoyed Doctor Strangelove. One has enjoyed Doctor Strangelove. What else is there? I mean, it's pretty much beyond compare.
There's not anything really... I mean, there are lots of disaster films. All disaster films, Poseidon Adventure. There's...
The original, by the way. Do not watch the remake. Just the original Poseidon
Adventure.
No, you
definitely watch a remake.
Oh, God.
But, like, real drunk as balls when you watch it. It's good. We could do Poseidon Adventure the remake when we get to pee.
We could do the Poseidon Adventure series, because there were three, weren't there? The original,
oh
or
God.
Two? There was a
sequel. We have to do it on board a boat. So let's get a boat sailing around Jersey, and we'll talk for hours about the Poseidon Adventure.
We're going to book a cruise in December.
Amazing.
Hang on. It was Christmas. It was New Year's.
It
that
was.
That is brilliant.
Is recording a podcast about the Poseidon Adventure whilst on a boat tempting fate, though?
No.
Oh, okay, ask and answer.
I mean, we're recording a podcast about potential nuclear cold war in a world where currently both the
After
US
today?
And the Russian major powers are in beneath the charge
really
of madmen.
He's fucked off America to Russia, I should say, today. He's been fucking off America for months, but he's fucked off Russia today. Anyway, so movies that you should watch. There is a movie called Failsafe, which came out a couple of months after. This film.
This was in production at the same time before.
Called Failsafe, and it's directed by Sidney Lumet, and it's got Walter Matthau and Henry Fonda. And it's essentially the same kind of thing, bringing the world back from the brink of nuclear disaster. Critically acclaimed, flopped at the box office, was being made at the same time, like you said, and Kubrick sued them. He sued them for copyright infringement on the original book, which is a bollocks, but somehow he got it through. And so it failed, basically. But
basically, he depo-dumped, because the big concern was that Failsafe would come out before Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah.
And I think Kubrick understood that there was only room for one film about this particular topic at a given time. And so, he just depo-dumped it. He stalled them in the courts.
Absolutely, yeah.
For long enough that he could get his movie finished. Man's a genius. Twisted
He wasn't
genius.
A nice man, to be honest with you, but very few of that type of genius are. There's, I mean, if you want to talk Peter Sellers, go and watch the Pink Panther films, because, I mean, they're not like this, but the Pink Panther films are just a shot in the dark. Whilst not an official Pink Panther film, is one of the greatest comedies of all time.
In fact, I think anything with Peter Sellers in
anything with Peter Sellers in, pretty much.
You're not going to go far wrong.
George C. Scott, go and see Patton, famously turned down the Oscar. You know, in, that opening speech is absolutely insane. I haven't seen it, but I'm just saying stuff I've heard on the internet. James Earl Jones, Star Wars.
Do not watch Star Wars for James Earl Jones.
Yeah, that would be a bit of a missed opportunity, wouldn't it?
That said, if you want to...
Field of Dreams?
Field of Dreams, if you must. Clear and Present Danger.
Ooh.
Any of the Jack Ryan series.
Hunt for the Red October.
Hunt for Red October.
Amazing in that. And it's got Sean Connery doing a Russian accent, but not really. Amazing. And young Alec Baldwin, the sexiest of all the Alec Baldwins.
Of all the Alec Baldwins.
He's got the eyes of an Arctic wolf.
But not of all the Baldwins, just of all
no,
of
the Alec Baldwins.
Baldwins.
I mean, he's always the sexiest of the Baldwins. But, and then, I mean, if you're talking, about a film about man's hubris in the face of a power that he can't really ever understand or harness, then really your number one recommendation is Event Horizon. You've got to go and watch Event Horizon. Because...
it's not happening, and that was probably the most tenuous
if
recommendation.
If you like Doctor Strangelove, you will love Doctor Event Horizon, apparently. You'll love it. You'll love it. It's the same film. Peter Sellers is amazing in Event... Sam Neill in Event Horizon is as good as... I can't even finish that sentence. I'm sorry.
No, no.
But you should watch Event Horizon.
If you have ever wanted the big board experience from Doctor Strangelove or War Games...
That's a really good recommendation, yeah.
Yeah,
really
yeah thank you. Missed that one completely. Still, end of the world with kids. Yeah. Then, yeah, there's a small British game studio called Introversion who made a game called DEFCON.
DEFCON?
DEFCON, as in DEFCON 1, 2, 3, 4, right. 5.
Not as in the DEFCON artist.
No. Like. Yeah, go and get that. It's dirt cheap. It's on Steam. And you get to basically... play thermonuclear war properly and obliterate the entire
universe. And what happens if your games console doesn't run on Steam, it runs on electricity?
Well, then you need to get behind the times, man.
I assume you're in some kind of weird steampunk reality where...
It got weird.
It's a bad joke. I apologise.
We're done here.
Are we going to finish on that bad joke?
Mic drop. We out.
This has been We're Drunk and We Know Things at the Cock and Bottle in the glorious sunshine drinking far too much Liberation Blonde. Next week, next month, whatever, at some point, maybe, I don't know, we'll be doing emojis, because that's what you voted for, you fucking weirdos.